This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, it's been a great month for Mumia Abu-Jamal. For the first time in decades, there's a chance for a real legal path to freedom for the nation's best-known political prisoner. We'll hear from Mumia and leaders of the movement to release him from a Pennsylvania prison.
But first, the Mueller report has been a disappointment to Democrats and most of the U.S. corporate media. For more than 2 years, they have been spinning a tale of collusion between WikiLeaks, the Russian government, and the Trump campaign. But special counsel Robert Mueller's verdict was that there was no collusion. Colleen Rowley is a former FBI agent and whistleblower who exposed the Bureau's failures leading up to the 9/11 attacks. Rowley has followed closely the Russiagate saga. Both Mueller and most of the news media continue to accept as biblical truth that Russians hacked the Democratic National Committee emails and gave them to WikiLeaks. But Rowley agrees that there is still no proof that that's the way it happened.
Exactly. And I have several reasons for questioning that aspect, which I just heard on NPR. They just said it's unquestioned. It's beyond, like you say, it's biblical at this point. It's gone down that the Russians, in fact, were responsible for some hacking. Now, you put this in a bigger context. Number one, nation states, and especially the United States, has for decades been involved in cyber sleuthing, spying, and even cyber attacks. I mean, some of that has become public. So the United States might be the leader in the whole world, but other countries do it as well. And if you've ever read a John le Carre novel from the Cold War era, the way this has always been handled throughout history has been through, at the most, when a spy is caught, there's some kind of usually a secret exchange. Later on, you know, the spies get returned back, etc. That's basically the counterintelligence world. That's all changed. I mean, it's been a sea change with the last couple of years. And using this kind of what would at best be grounds for a counterintelligence investigation, something secret, whatever, turning it into a public, basically public lynching, even without any evidence. And unfortunately, the consequence of that is that it has put us on the verge of confrontation with a nuclear superpower or superpowers, actually more than one. And it's also now led to us revoking the First Amendment right of publishers to publish information. And now, of course, this is something that's not being regurgitated at all on NPR, and I suspect on most other channels, but this is the bigger issue. And as far as Trump is concerned, frankly, it undermines his presidency. I don't know that he had any great altruistic motives in his campaign promise of kind of rolling back what the Obama administration had done, which was to ramp up a new Cold War on Russia. Obama and Susan Rice and Brennan and all the rest, for some reason, thought it was a good idea to start a new Cold War with Russia towards the end of the Obama administration. And when Trump was campaigning, he, for whatever reason, and I think there probably are a couple of reasons that are not so altruistic and certainly not necessarily for peace in the world, et cetera. I think one of the reasons, frankly, was that Bannon had told him that China should be the bigger enemy and that he should triangulate and try to maybe make a wedge between Russia and China. I think from a strategic standpoint, maybe Bannon had, and Bannon says this all the time, and I think Bannon had probably convinced him of that. So in other words, he was promising a more of a detente and rapprochement with Russia. And this really scared the military industrial congressional, I guess Ray McGovern calls it the military industrial congressional, media, academic, think tank complex. I've heard it also called the blob in Washington, D.C. This departure, or what they didn't approve of in terms of any kind of detente with Russia, made a lot of them go crazy. And this early part of this, this is another thing NPR is leaving out. They're not explaining how it started. And so they leave out all that Christopher Steele dossiers that were apparently largely concocted, if not fully concocted. And it, what's weird enough, bizarre enough, they were in theory, or at least, you know, said to be concocted with the Russians. That's incredible that our media just totally leaves out that this is how it all started. This is what, how the FBI started its investigation of Trump campaign, and actually including FISA warrants and everything else. I heard that point mentioned once, and only by the spokesperson for the Republican Party, that mentioned the Steele dossiers and having started this. If you think about it, if you're an innocent person who now is got some nutty dossier out there floating, leaked to the press to discredit you, to discredit your policies, etc., what would an innocent person do if you're being framed, essentially? Well, most innocent people, or at least some of them, you know, would say, okay, I just, you know, continue besmirching me and making up stuff and leaking about me, etc. Well, most of them would fight back. And I think that this is where Barr and even Mueller have understood that even if you're totally innocent of a crime, and in fact, a crime didn't even occur, a crime of conspiracy can't even be made out, what would an innocent person do? Well, an innocent person would say, well, call me. You're not telling me the truth. In fact, you are investigating me, but then you tell the public that you're not. You know, so an innocent person would get mad, and as I think Barr said, frustrated. And this intent that they can't prove is why Mueller refused to opine on a collusion aspect, because, you know, the intent's very, very important. And in fact, what does an innocent person do? I heard that point mentioned once, and that was only by someone who was a defense attorney on NPR. The larger points on NPR is that it looks like everyone is going to continue this Russiagate debacle for another day, and just continue to push it and push it. That's where it seems to be heading. No one's willing to move on at this point. This puts us in a really bad, dangerous situation, again, with this war mentality. That's the bigger issue here.
Yes, as Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone has pointed out, the corporate media has behaved far more badly during these years of Russiagate, even than it behaved with the run-up to the Iraq War.
Absolutely. And if you think about the Watergate, Watergate's exposer was one of them, was Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward, months ago, said the same thing that the Mueller report said, no collusion with the Trump campaign. And yet, even though he was one of these, I guess, highly regarded guys who exposed Watergate, it got zero traction. What Woodward said is, you know, I've investigated this for a year. I talked to the same people Mueller's talking to. And you know what? Couldn't find any collusion. The mainstream media, just like crickets. And they never repeated. You had to look long and hard to even find what Bob Woodward had said. So that's a telling window onto their mindset. When they got invested, the media itself got invested with this dossier early on, because Steele, working with DNC and who knows who, was being peddled to a lot of them. And they uncritically used that Steele dossier in their own stuff. And when that happens, they then become invested in the narrative and the story. And they're not about to, still to this day, they're not about to let it go. And they're trying to make up again, you know, fallback positions, etc. The other thing is, of course, Trump had, you know, then fully gave up on whatever campaign promises he had made before. And then having hired all these neocons like Bolton and Abrams and them bringing in their teams, I don't think that there's any chance or very little chance that he would go back and then try to honor any of his it's amazing. The media sees him trying to honor his campaign promises, some of which were good. pulling out of Syria and some of these things where he was criticizing his predecessors. And so he said these wars were stupid. But now that's seen as some kind of traitor actions with the so-called enemy. Even ending war now is seen as, you know, they call you names, you know, Saddam lover and Putinista and all these other things. Even meeting with foreign nations, even the head of North Korea. Our media now frames that as somehow you must be a puppet of the other government if you want to meet with them and talk about mutual threats, etc. It's pretty amazing. It's mostly, I totally agree with Matt Taibbi. This seems to be a creature of the media and official leaks from former officials, mostly people like Brennan and Clapper and whatever, the people who fueled this with the media, are to blame for having put us on this dangerous, dangerous footing right now. Not that Trump right now, because he's hired all the neocon war hawks, so they really have gotten what they've always sought and wanted from the start, which was control, you know, what Eisenhower warned about, which was the military-industrial blah, blah, blah complex, has gotten its control over the president, which is what Eisenhower warned about, you know, decades and decades ago.
So in that sense, Russiagate has been a success for some of the forces behind it.
I think that's the case. The less of a success might be for the Democrats, you know, because it's hard to tell at this point what 2020 is going to bring. But they went a little too far, perhaps, you know, Adam Schiff and Schumer and all the rest, I think may have gone a little too far in what they were alleging. Rachel Maddow. I think they may have gone a little too far, and maybe that will kind of prove counterproductive for them in the 2020 election, in that they made these kind of unbelievable wild claims about things that now have been really debunked. I mean, some parts of this have been debunked. The official position now is a fallback position that I'm deducing from NPR coverage, which is that, you know, they can at least say that Mueller did not decide on obstruction. And if his attorney had followed his advice, whatever, it could have been obstruction. So they've come back with this weak kind of fallback position. I think what's important for the public to know, again, this is not going to be said except on sites like yourself. It's only going to be said in this, what we should say is kind of a true journalism, is that we really need to look at publication of facts. And with WikiLeaks, you cannot deny that what they published was factual, in the very same vein as what the Washington Post and 18 other main newspapers published during the end of the Vietnam War, when Daniel Ellsberg took the Pentagon Papers. At that time, the media certainly was challenged. Even Cronkite in the early days wasn't telling the truth about stuff. However, later in the Vietnam War, we did have those 18, 19 newspapers that were willing to publish facts. That's pretty amazing, even though these facts were certainly ran counter to continuing the Vietnam War. Right now in our country, we are not there. We are not there. It's quite the opposite. The media now is willing to say that publishing of facts is a form of treason. It's a form of espionage on the part of the foreign countries, even though most of our media ran with WikiLeaks about the Iraq war. They did cover that, and they covered the embassy cables, and some of them even covered the true, authentic emails of the DNC that showed rigging. So even though they did, they've all pulled away from that now, and they've gone into this mode that we have to put into prison publishers of information. And that's really the most dangerous thing in the world for democracy. And I don't think the Mueller report's going to lead us out of that at all, just simply because they have not really gone into the, I kind of swayed from the original question here about Mueller's indictments. Mueller's indictments of Russians, which was the IRA, extremely specious, buying, what, $100,000 of ads showing Hillary Clinton wrestling Jesus. I mean, and the funny thing is, Mueller the fact that he would use that, the fact that he would use this as somehow meddling in the election, this silliness about these ads that had nobody saw them. I mean, they were just nothings. And the fact that he would then use that in an indictment, it's self-telling. It is so weak. And the ads didn't even run before the election. They ran afterwards. They didn't even, you know, at the most they could say, well, they were just so discord or something, but they didn't really do anything in terms of electoral politics. So that indictment, which is nothing. And then the other indictment of what he claims are GRU affiliates that somehow hacked the DNC and maybe Podesta or whatever. And of course, Mueller, I just have to say two or three reasons why I find that one is pretty weak as well. And the one thing is that Mueller has a track record of being wrong. He was wrong. He went after the wrong anthrax killer early on. The government had to pay $5 million to this poor Stephen Hatfield, totally innocent. And you know who was behind that? Mueller. So to put him on a pedestal as if he's, you know, some kind of detective god at this point is ridiculous. He also seems to have played a role. The Boston newspaper said he even played a role in supporting the Whitey Bulger, the FBI's operating of Whitey Bulger, and then framing innocent people for Whitey Bulger's murders. He was the acting U.S. attorney in Boston at the time. And it kind of shows you there are other things as well in Mueller's history that just show that he does things for expediency. A main thing that Mueller did for expediency was to parrot the Colin Powell false intelligence to the UN. And he simply went into Congress and parroted it. Now, did he have any reason to know any of this? And frankly, he had reason to know the opposite of some of those pieces of intelligence. But no, he just goes in. Why? Because it's expedient. He's going with the flow. And he's done this many, many times. So his track record isn't that great. In the case of indicting the Russians, whoever these were, I should put Russians in quotes, because hackers are kind of, many of them are nationless. They don't really identify as part of a country. Sometimes they do. Our NSA, who hires hackers, yes, they identify as part of the U.S. And who knows who these hackers or people who actually got the information. It's very murky as to how this information was actually obtained. It could have been any kind of hackers, and certainly it could have been some loose affiliation with the Russian government. I don't know. Nor does Mueller know. He's using some circumstantial information in that indictment, and his information that he used in there has been actually pretty effectively challenged by independent forensic researchers. It's not to say that they necessarily know all the answers either. Mueller had the benefit and the latitude of knowing that his allegations in there would never be challenged. Because, of course, any Russian who came over here and said, you know, I plead not guilty, would already not have the benefit of a fair trial in our environment, especially in our environment. So, of course, no Russian was going to do that. So you can understand that Mueller didn't have too many qualms about going with the flow and going with the former intelligence assessment that Brennan and Clapper and all the rest with strong motivations, because they were part of disseminating that dossier, that Steele dossier, early on and leading to improper investigations, et cetera, of Carter, Page, all the rest. And well, they were all part of that.
And the Mueller investigation never attempted to contact the two most important people, who are Julian Assange, and they knew where to reach him, and the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, who says that the thumb drive with the DNC documents were handed to him by an insider at the DNC, and that there was no hack at all.
It's my understanding that there were some negotiations. Now, this goes back a couple of years, I think, before the Russiagate actually got really ramped up. I think there were some negotiations to talk to Assange. And obviously, they would have had to provide immunity. But immunity for what? For the so-called espionage investigation that Obama had launched, that they had already decided was not going to be prosecuted. And so there was some negotiations, but somehow they got quashed. And then when the Trump administration came in because of Pompeo and Bolton wanting to, you know, go with this war mentality again and take what was a Cold War and, you know, make it warmer, I should say, and maybe even a hot war, which is what they talk about all the time. Those negotiations are probably dead in the water at this point. Rand Paul suggested this just recently. And if you think about it, if the United States really did have a goal, an honest goal of investigating how this was leaked, let's say that they wanted to prevent. You know, one of the reasons for prosecuting crimes is to prevent future crimes of the same nature. So if they really did want to prevent this type of so-called hacking, which they claim actually is an act of war, and et cetera, if they really wanted to prevent that, you know what? The first person you would talk to would be Julian Assange. I don't know if just giving him near immunity would mean that he would talk about his sources, because he's got the highest journalism ethics ever. It's possible that Julian Assange would actually, you know, go to prison for life or et cetera before he would give up a source, because he truly does have these journalism ethics. So it's hard to know. But on the other hand, you know what? They're also not even trying. And it really casts some suspicion on the fact that they don't really care. They don't really care about these things that have happened. What they want to do is shut down journalism. I read something in a great article. John Pilger said that there's a British military document that somehow he saw that actually says that of the three threats to good public order in the United Kingdom are terrorism, the Russians, and investigative journalism. And of those three, the top threat is investigative journalism. And there actually is an official document that says this, and it's in John Pilger's article. Of course, we're not going to hear that on NPR. NPR, I call it National Propaganda Radio these days, because all they do is run with the war propaganda. And they did it with Iraq, and they're doing it again now. That's the problem, is investigative journalism has got its head on the chopping block right now. And that's the biggest factor. And then, of course, the other thing is, here we are in this Cold War turning warmer and warmer with nuclear superpowers. And I would say fairly insane power people at the top with their fingers on the button. And that's not just the United States. It's when people get scared and these threats and this bullying are happening, it does mimic the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it mimics other times. When people are scared on both sides, even normal, halfway decent people are scared, it puts us all into peril. Because the first time a flock of geese or a weather balloon or whatever gets mistaken and a plane gets shot down or someone spots something on the radar, this has now got people that are scared out of their minds of the so-called enemy. And Khrushchev and Gorbachev especially, and Reagan even at some point, recognized how close we had come to just ending the entire planet because of this kind of fear-inspired situation. And if Russiagate, you're absolutely right. If that was the goal, it really wasn't to end cyber sleuthing and spying, because our government's going to continue that in full force. Of course they don't want to end that. But if the goal was to ramp up more war and fear, that's been very, very successful.
That was whistleblower and former FBI agent Colleen Rowley.
The prospects for freedom for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal changed radically this month, 37 years after he was found guilty in the death of a Philadelphia policeman. Larry Krasner, the district attorney of Philadelphia, announced that he would not try to reverse a local court decision allowing Abu-Jamal to appeal his conviction. Noel Hanrahan is a producer and founder of Prison Radio, where Abu-Jamal has for decades been a journalist, which was his profession before his arrest in 1982. Hanrahan explains how the legal breakthrough happened.
The Common Pleas Court Judge, Leon Tucker, he gave Mumia relief, which meant that he reinstated all of the appeals that have occurred over the last 15 years. And that represents a lot of evidence and a lot of opportunity for Mumia to actually get back into court and argue for a new trial. So it's critical. We haven't seen this in 25 years. Mumia himself said the other day that he's feeling hopeful for the first time since he was in the Common Pleas Court in 1995.
The times have changed. The evidence, however, has not. How would things be different in a new trial?
The thing that's dramatic is that this is the first time a judge in Philadelphia has ruled in Mumia's favor ever. The very first trial he had was run by Albert F. Szabo, who was a hanging judge who said, I'm going to help them fry the N-word. He said that in court to a court clerk in front of another judge. That's the kind of trial that Mumia had originally. All of those rulings had been upheld. He hadn't actually ever before December 27th of 2018 received a positive ruling from a local Philadelphia judge. That's what happened. Now, we've also seen in the past 2 days, the first time ever that the district attorney's office has not contested his right to appeal his case. So the district attorney withdrew their opposition to his appellate arguments and relief, which is unheard of. So we are in a totally different place. And I have to actually say, it's really the local grassroots organizing, it's people, it's the Larry Krasner district attorney being elected by the people who was not a candidate of the Democrats or the right wing or the Fraternal Order of Police. He was a people's candidate. So there's things happening on the ground in Philadelphia that are dramatically changing what is possible. And what's possible is that he's getting the first opportunity, the very first opportunity to hear this new evidence. You talked about evidence. There is actual evidence of Mumia's innocence that's been suppressed, police misconduct, actual crime scene photos that have never been looked at in court, recantation evidence from witnesses. There's a lot that is now on the table that he has to argue for. I mean, he's arguing in appellate courts. And so he's arguing before a Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is better than it was 2 years ago, but it's still pretty conservative. So he has a long way to go. And the district attorney has not said that he's not going to not argue against a new trial, but he's allowing him to actually go to court. He's not fighting the fact that he's getting that opportunity. So Larry Krasner said to The Intercept, look, you guys shouldn't be worried about my appealing the Castile decision or these current things that Krasner is doing because I gave you the boxes. Now, what that means is Larry Krasner found 6 large banker's boxes full of original trial material from Mumia's case. And he turned it over to the defense. He said, you're going to be very happy, which means that there's evidence in there that was suppressed. It's very, very likely. These boxes were from a move when the district attorney's office moved in 2000, and they hadn't been opened, and they probably hadn't been turned over to the defense. So they have a year from when the boxes were turned over on December 29th. They have a year to file a claim of Brady evidence or a claim that there is information in there that could have changed the outcome of the trial. So those boxes are what could be the bullet train to a new trial for Mumia. The appellate process that we're going through now with the Castile appeal, that would take longer. It's going to go up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. There'll be a long time it takes to develop the paperwork and the briefs and the arguments. But a new trial based on Brady evidence could be much quicker. And that is a definite possibility. So there are many avenues to freedom. And there's going to be an enormous amount of pressure for all of the prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, which there was extensive police misconduct in this case, and suppression of evidence. So those things are all going to come out.
So when you can show that the prosecution suppressed evidence that could have shown innocence, that is supposed to be a prima facie reason for a new trial.
You know, I've been in law school now for 2 years, and I'm finishing the second year at Rutgers in my second year. And I've been deeply disturbed. It's much worse than I thought. So I've been studying the Post-Conviction Relief Act, and I've been studying, which replaced habeas. So there were so many prisoners in Pennsylvania that they took away habeas corpus because there were too many prisoners. To have an efficient system, they needed to lessen how many briefs were being filed by prisoners. And so they instituted this thing called the Post-Conviction Relief Act, which limits prisoners' opportunity to ask for relief. And it's far worse than I thought. So that's the issue, is they're going to take every opportunity to limit how people can get into court. And so, yes, there's absolute evidence that was suppressed by the police. There are crime scene photos that have never been adjudicated in court that show a totally different crime scene. They were taken by the Philadelphia Bulletin minutes after the shooting. They show a completely different crime scene than the crime scene photos that the police produced at trial. And they have never been entered into court before. So there's eyewitness testimony that has been dismissed because he's never had an opportunity to rule on the merits. He's never had evidence heard in court. The PCRA has denied him at every moment the ability to get into court. But like you said, suppressed evidence, these boxes, they were from 2000. They weren't able to be scrubbed. They weren't, Seth Williams and the people before Seth Williams weren't able to like take the material out. And also I think there's a psychology. There's some weird psychology about people who do things like that. They keep the boxes. Who does that? Like they keep the evidence that they suppress. It's kind of shocking, but it's true. Like they keep evidence of innocence. And it happens in case after case after case, where they find in somebody's garage these notes. You know, and Larry Krasner found it in a utility closet.
And so suddenly, all of this material now have an active potential life.
Absolutely. Like, he's really got, if there's material in those boxes that we still don't know, I mean, Mumia's lawyers have looked at the materials, then, you know, a week after those six boxes came out, the DA's office said there was 100 more boxes that he found. Now, those boxes didn't have Mumia's name written on the side, but they were from the same time period, and they're, you know, figuring out which cases they were involved in. But there's a lot of material that Krasner's office is going through and trying to manage. Now, they've been telling us that they have a lot on their plate. Krasner's office is making dramatic changes that are really and very revolutionary and positive for criminal justice issues. But there's a lot of corruption. There was like decades and decades and decades of police corruption and prosecutorial misconduct. So they're looking at what they can manage. And right now they're doing like 2010 up. They're not looking at old cases because they have to manage a police list of police witnesses that they can't use that are current because of the scandals that have been happening. I've lived in Philadelphia now for 10 years. Every single week, there's a front page article about police corruption scandals. There is a culture in the police department of misconduct. And if we had a more vigorous press, we would have the ability really to understand how deep that goes. Like, for instance, I go to the FOP websites. I'm a private investigator. I'm also in law school. I went to the FOP website yesterday, and right on the top banner headline is, we're giving notice to all police officers who have been retired that you must refuse any internal affairs investigation that tries to interview you about any topic whatsoever. They're actively coaching their police officers to not cooperate. What we need, which is like a truth and reconciliation process. We've had a culture of incarceration and the targeting of poor people and people of color in our city for decades. And so that has to be exposed. People have to be held accountable, and there has to be some level of redress. And it's got to happen. But the 6,500 person strong police department is the son of Frank Rizzo, and nothing has changed. It's the same with the police, right? It's the same way with the judges.
That's what I was about to say. This same Fraternal Order of Police, which urges its members not to cooperate with investigators, is buddy-buddy, a campaign contributor to Wines and Dines with judges.
The other thing is they've constructed the assembly line where poor people's bodies are used as fuel for this system. And those are the judges, a smaller number of people of a different class, but still culpable and responsible. And they knew that the police were corrupt. They knew that the prosecutor was corrupt. They understood as soon as one scandal happens, it's not one person's individual case that it exposes what the police did, but they did that in every single case, right? So the judges created a system that they are now trying to preserve, and they are resisting every single thing that Larry Krasner is trying to change about the criminal justice system. And they're entrenched, and they want to preserve their legacy, and they want to believe that they did the right thing. Well, I'm sorry. They have to understand that the system that they created, that is an assembly line for poor people of color, has got to be abolished. And they are standing in the way right now. So the grassroots movement are what is fundamentally changing it for Mumia and everybody else. Mumia is extraordinary, but he's also ordinary. And it's people's families and the Human Rights Coalition and the Amistad Law Project and CADBE, the Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration. Those groups are changing what's possible. They're the people who elected Krasner, and they just started a month ago a judges accountability public table where they're inviting judges to come into the community, and they're telling them what the people want. And the judges are showing up, and they're being politically strategic. And that is why we have the Van Jones opportunist event happening. That's why the reform movement started, is because they see that the local grassroots people are forcing fundamental change in Philadelphia. And that's where we're going to win, because we're going to hold these people accountable. And I'm just so, you know, happy and proud. And it's a moment where things can change. And Philadelphia is up south. Philadelphia is the heart of the problem. We have the fourth largest death row. We had the most juvenile lifers out of 1,500 juvenile lifers in the country. 500 were from Pennsylvania. We have 5,000 lifers who are doing life without possibility of parole. We have a seriously broken criminal justice system, and it's about to change.
That was Noelle Hanrahan speaking from Philadelphia.
Johanna Fernandez is a professor of history at Baruch College in New York, but she spends much of her time as an organizer with the campaign to bring Mumia home. We asked Fernandez if she's talked with Mumia since the good news arrived.
Yes, I did speak to Mumia last night, and Mumia, as you can imagine, has waited for this moment for 36 or 37 years, so he is truly over the moon. And, you know, as usual, he gives thanks to the movement, the people who have traveled to Philadelphia, who've marched on his behalf in New York, in France, in Mexico, in Brazil, around the world. And he continues to say that he's been sustained by the love that he's been given by people who believe in freedom.
How legally significant and politically significant is it that the Philadelphia district attorney isn't standing in the way anymore?
Well, it's politically significant because, as you know, the Philadelphia establishment and the Fraternal Order of Police have for all of these years, over three decades now, shut the door to the possibility of an opening in this case. How? They've pretty much bought off judges. So Ron Castile was funded by the Fraternal Order of Police. The judge who sat in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that denied Mumia's appeal was funded by the Fraternal Order of Police, the same institution that was trying to get Mumia executed. So this opens the opportunity for Philadelphia's native son, someone who's been demonized in the court of public opinion by the press, by politicians, someone whose case has been used to crank up the apparatus of mass incarceration in Pennsylvania. And we saw that in the 1980s and 90s and even recently. This case is now a case that was believed to be open and shut by the powers that be is now being reopened. And now a new generation of young people, but also a new generation of journalists who are less influenced by the power of the Fraternal Order of Police are going to begin to inquire about the violations in this case. What's important for people to remember is that all of the violations of Mumia's case, prosecutorial misconduct, the suppression of evidence to obtain a conviction, police corruption, and the framing of a defendant, judicial bias, all of these issues are the issues that dog defendants across the country. And these are the issues responsible for the crisis of mass incarceration. And if a case as famous as this one, the world over, is cracked open, this will mean that the edifice of mass incarceration will be cracked in a very compromising way. And there will be international attention, not just on Mumia's case and all of the violations in it, but in all the other cases in the United States wherein prisoners were framed or overcharged or coerced to say that they were guilty. So the political significance is great. Another thing is that this is not just the case of any prisoner. This is a case of a political prisoner. And if one of the world's most famous political prisoner is freed, that's going to raise a conversation in public discourse about political imprisonment and all of the other U.S.-held political prisoners who were incarcerated in the post-Black Power movement era.
I'm sure Mumia's supporters are overjoyed, but will this latest development find expression on the streets?
Oh, absolutely. This morning, we are gathering in Philadelphia in front of the DA's office at noon, and we're expecting a very large crowd. The media in Philadelphia, which rarely reports positively on Mumia's case, is covering this widely, and the headlines are shocking and dramatic. So this is an opportunity, in fact, to educate Philadelphians on a case that is world famous, but one that has not really been reported on by the media corps, by the bourgeois media in that city. So we are determined to build the movement in the streets, for sure. And Wednesday, as you know, is Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday, April 24th, 2019. It's Mumia's birthday, and as usual, the movement is convening to celebrate his life and his commitment to the Black radical tradition. And the title of the meeting is The 411 on the Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It comes at a propitious moment given the new developments in the case. So we encourage everyone to come out to the Commons in Brooklyn from 7 to 9. We will be screening Justice on Trial, the Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a short film with an enormous heart on the case, which features all of the police corruption in the case. And then we are going to give an update on the legal development.
The Commons is located on Atlantic Avenue at Bond Street in Brooklyn. Mumia Abu-Jamal was in great spirits even before he got word that the district attorney would not stand in the way of his appeal. Mumia's supporters held a gala fundraiser in Berkeley, California, featuring Angela Davis, Alice Walker, and Judith Ritter. From imprisonment in Pennsylvania, Abu-Jamal spoke to the crowd at the Evening for Justice and Freedom.
We are rising. For the first time in years, our forces are building again, cohering again, marching again. In California, an all-star roster of activists, writers, and revolutionaries are coming together, marking a new period, a time of freedom. We're not saying nor suggesting that the movement has been quiescent. No, for it hasn't been. It has fought the good fight for life and health that has had national impact in prison systems literally across the country. I'm speaking here of the state's attempt to deny treatment for hepatitis C, an affliction that touches the lives of at least some 700,000 men and women in America's crowded prisons. Our people filled courtrooms and hit the streets to demand change and antiviral treatment for Hep C sufferers like me. They demanded change and made change that continues to radiate across America. A black doctor and internist from New York, Dr. Joseph Harris, took the stand and taught the world about Hep C. This passionate, informed analysis of Hep C demolished the DOC's obstruction to treatment and opened the door to new precedents for Hep C sufferers. With the help of our lawyers, Brett Grote and Robert Boyle, established a new legal precedent that has helped thousands of imprisoned Hep C sufferers all across America live longer and healthier lives. Your support made it possible. Now, in California, we are continuing the march towards freedom. For soon, you will hear from some friends of our movement on the steps to come. People like Angela Davis, who herself years ago faced multiple death penalty charges until she was freed. Groundbreaking she is, an abolitionist and an anti-incarceration scholar and founder of Critical Resistance, a group that continues to fight against the prison industrial complex. Alice Walker, a literary lion and womanist, feminist activist and icon. Judith Ritter, Widener University Law School professor and author of several law review articles on criminal justice. Pam Africa, MOVE's Minister of Confrontation and founder of the international concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Jeff Mackler, editor of Socialist Action newspaper and radical activist who has worked lifelong on behalf of people's movements and struggles. From anti-imperial war and to the historic Lynn Stewart fight for freedom to our own. Professor Eula Taylor, African-American studies professor at UC Santa Barbara, who has taught prisoners at Lompoc. And Stephen Bingham. Remember the young dude who the cops said smuggled a weapon into George Jackson when he was in Soledad? That's the dude. He spent 13 years in France before he came back, went to trial, and was acquitted. Attorney, recently retired, Stephen Bingham. Voices of resistance, of rebellion, of new life, and of freedom. We are rising. The scent of freedom is in the air. This is our time to mobilize, to build, to create social change. This is the time, and we are that change. Won't you join us? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Pan Africa is with the MOVE organization in Philadelphia and a key member of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She spoke at the gala in Berkeley and paid respect to Mumia's prison mates.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.